government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much
business and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of the Free Lunch Podcast for the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. As always, please visit RTP's website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Now, as always, I'm Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. As I mentioned, this is a very special podcast in that it's not being aired live. It's not one of our teleforms, so there won't be any Q&A in this podcast. But what we do have is a really exciting conversation between Greg McNeil and Adam Thierer. Greg, I ask that you please introduce yourself, and then we'll go to Adam, and then I think we'll just launch right into discussing the Regulatory Transparency Project and the role that the Emerging Tech Working Group plays on that. Greg, can you just introduce yourself?
Sure, yeah. My name is Gregory McNeil. I'm a professor of law and public policy at Pepperdine University. I also dabble a little bit in the startup world as the co-founder of a technology startup that basically creates an airspace management safety platform for drones and other autonomous flying devices, and I'm the chair of the Regulatory Transparency Project's Emerging Technology Working Group.
Cool. Thanks, Greg. Did you mention what the name of that company is?
The company is called AirMap.
Awesome. Adam, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Adam Thierer. I'm a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, where I study and write on the public policy implications of various emerging technologies. And I've spent 25 years in this field with five different research organizations dealing with technology policy.
Thanks a lot to both you guys. I should add to Adam's introduction there that he is one of the members on our Emerging Technology Working Group as well. Greg and Adam are going to be discussing not only that working group and the Regulatory Transparency Project itself, but also why we even need this sort of thing and a project on regulation and innovation and opportunity. One thing I'd like to say before I toss up the first question to these guys is I remind you that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch podcasts are those of our featured speakers. So the first question that I have, and I think we can just sort of be freewheeling with this, guys, is to Greg. Greg, you're the chair of RTP's Emerging Technology Working Group. Can you give us a little background on the working group, why it's necessary in a project that's looking at regulation and trying to create some discussion around regulation and hurdles to our economy? Can you give us a little background on the Emerging Tech Working Group?
Happy to do it. It almost didn't exist, the working group, which I think is emblematic of the nascent nature of the challenge that the Emerging Technology Working Group is trying to address, and really what we're trying to spearhead. And it goes back to a conversation I had very early on with Gene Meyer, where I came to him sort of out of the blue and I said, I think that Federal Society practice groups are missing an important component. And so this was, we have practice groups related to national security and intellectual property and, you know, administrative law and the environment and just a variety of different things that you might think of as organizing principles for how you might have a law firm or like the research areas for law professors. And Gene and I went to dinner and I said to him, I said, the challenge with the way the practice groups are oriented is that there's a wide swath of government activity that is stifling economic development and stifling liberty that doesn't fall neatly into any one practice area, but has big, broad implications for the direction of the law and the direction of policy. And the specific example I gave him, because my research was about drones, was drones. And I said, you know, drones raise issues, sure, related to privacy or government surveillance, but they might also raise issues that would otherwise fall into a group that might be looking at privacy issues. But then there are regulatory issues because drones are an entirely new technology that we're trying to shove into an old regulatory box at the FAA. And all of a sudden you find that drones are this emerging nascent technology that can be threatened by very many different forms and regulatory impulses. And then, you know, that conversation between Gene and I emerged into, there are other things like this. All of a sudden, someone picking you up in a car because you used an app looks a lot like a taxi to a regulator, even though it bears very little resemblance to taxis, and the issues raised by taxis are distinct from those that might be raised by Ubers. And same thing for sort of Airbnb. And we just started to realize there was a whole cluster of economic activity that was being touched by the law, and it was a significant issue that we needed to organize some thought around. And the easiest way to kind of summarize this is there's this idea of new technology. A bunch of people in government, elected officials or sort of in bureaucracies or just in society or in think tanks say, oh my gosh, there might be problems with that technology, and then we better do something. And it has analogs to in the criminal law world where there's some new activity and someone says, well, we need a new law. We need a new criminal law. And it becomes you know, almost a path to a potential oppressive regime that stifles these technologies. And so we wanted a place where we could organize our thinking around that cross-cutting issues, and the Emerging Technology Working Group was formed.
Thanks, Greg. And just for clarity, for anyone who's listening to this podcast who's not as familiar with the Federalist Society, Gene Meyer is the president of the Federalist Society. So it makes, I guess it brings a little more emphasis to the point that we need an emerging tech working group, that someone who has been the president of the Federalist Society since essentially its founding would think that this is an important thing to take on. And based on what you said, Greg, that seems right. Let me tease something up for Adam here. Adam, you are the author of a book about quote-unquote permissionless innovation. Now, I think this, there's at least a couple different visions for innovation policy. So permissionless innovation, which you've advocated for, versus precautionary innovation or precautionary approach to emerging technology. Can you give us a little background on that and why you come down on one side rather than the other?
Sure. So permissionless innovation versus the precautionary principle is essentially the dividing line or the major fault line upon which we see all innovation policy debates breaks down in America and across the globe today. Basically, the precautionary principle is well known. It's something that we've talked about a lot in the field of environmental politics or food and drug law, and it basically refers to the idea that no new technologies or innovations should be allowed on the market until such time as they've been proven to be perfectly safe and effective and risk-free, and that somebody needs to come to Washington or some capital or some regulatory body and prove that before we allow innovation to go forward. The counter to that, which didn't really have a name before the internet came along, but now we use this name of permissionless innovation. It should be clear that this is not something I came up with. It's a term that has had some great currency within technology policy circles in recent years, specifically in the internet world. And it basically stands for the proposition that innovation should be innocent until proven guilty, that until such time as you can show that there's an actual serious risk associated with a new technology, we should give that technology and those innovators the benefit of the doubt and allow those innovations to go on and take place without having to get some sort of prior blessing from some overarching bureaucrat or regulator. So that's the key differentiating vision, conflict of visions, if you will, to borrow a phrase from Tom Sowell, that really defines the modern technology policy landscape.
Well, I mean, that's so I appreciate the backstory, but why did you come down on permissionless innovation? I mean, aren't most people inclined to think, and Greg, you know, please jump in if you think a question from you would be better. But, I mean, aren't people more inclined to say, look, I just want security and safety, and we ought to have some person ensuring that any emerging technology is, you know, secure and safe and is not going to be, for example, you know, autonomous vehicles running off the road and killing people. Why would you come down on the side of permissionless innovation, which seems, you know, pretty scary?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. But the answer is that there can be no reward without some risk, that we only get progress and prosperity as a country, as a culture, as a people, as an economy, by engaging in ongoing trial and error experimentation, taking on new challenges and opportunities, even when they entail some risk. And this is something that obviously is a little bit scary to some people, and yet this is really the heart of not just a capitalist system, but any free system that wants to encourage some sort of innovative activities by its people. And it's why some countries prosper and others do not. And this gets into the specific empirical or economic evidence as to why innovation is so important, which is that most political scientists and economists all agree that technological innovation is widely considered to be the main source of economic progress. And the Obama administration had a report in 2010 that put some numbers on this. And it said, quote, in this 2010 report from the Obama administration, that technological innovation is linked to 3/4 of this nation's post-World War II growth rate, and that, quote, innovation in capital goods is the primary driver in increases in real wages and accounts for 75% of differences in income across countries. So this is a really important thing when you think about what provides for long-term prosperity and human flourishing. The answer is primarily technological innovation.
So Adam, you know, one of the hard for the listeners, Adam and I agree on almost all of these things, and so some of my questions will be devil's advocate, and some will be actually like the one I'm about to ask now, which are the hardest questions that get posed to me when I articulate a worldview very similar to Adam's, and that's this one. It's so if we go with a permissionless based approach, there's risk involved, and essentially what we're doing is we're allowing for a whole bunch of experiments to happen in the wild in a way where they're going to endanger people. And the two variants of this that I hear are in autonomous vehicles, surface vehicles, so autonomous or driverless cars, we might call them. The critique is we're basically letting big company X, you know, experiment on our streets with really no rules, and all of us are suffering the consequences of that experimentation, or at least we're suffering the risk of getting run over by one of these experiments that really should be happening in a closed environment, right? So that's one version of it. The other is I actually heard someone at the FAA, I think it was the administrator of the FAA, say basically these Silicon Valley companies want to use the national airspace system as their experimentation ground, putting all of us at risk. And then the second move, so that's the first thing that's hard for me to grapple with, but it leads to the second move. And the second rhetorical move there is, if you then accept that people are experimenting in these ways, the move two for them is to say, so shouldn't we at least use the existing regulations for regular cars or regular aircraft? Shouldn't these guys at least have to comply with the accepted safety standards we already have for everything else? Why do they get a free pass for being something new and different, putting all of us at risk? I don't know how to answer those questions, and I'm wondering how you grapple with those types of questions when they're posed to you.
Sure. Well, there's a couple of different answers, but the primary one comes down to the question of what works. We should not endorse permissionless innovation on a blind faith. We should endorse it on the idea that other systems have been tried and have ultimately failed to produce greater, not only progress, prosperity, and economic growth, but in some cases, greater safety or consumer welfare. I like to give this example. For many, many years, we regulated the traditional transportation and hospitality sectors on the grounds that they needed to be regulated to achieve the three primary goals of regulatory economics, which is lower prices, more choices, and higher quality products and services. Well, the sad thing is that for 70 years or so, we tried all that, and it failed miserably. We screwed consumers. We didn't get lower prices. We didn't get higher quality, and ultimately, we didn't even get greater safety. And then along comes Uber, and along comes Airbnb, and as sort of evasive entrepreneurs, they, in a way, thumbed their nose at the system and said, we're going to experiment with something new and better because we think we've got a better plan, and we don't even really think we're going to seek permission for this. We're just going to try it. And a lot of people were up in arms about that. But look what we have today. For the first time in decades, we enjoy the fruits of that sort of evasive entrepreneurship. We enjoy lower prices, more quality, higher choices. That's a real success story that we would not have known unless they engaged in a little bit of that sort of technological civil disobedience. Second quick point, just because one endorses permissionless innovation, we should not consider this to be synonymous with anarchy. There are still many other types of remedies when things go wrong, starting with the fact that, as far as I can tell, nobody's talking about abolishing the common law or other types of guidelines that are in existence for the sort of really egregious, what I'll call corner cases of technological harm.
So what do you do about let's do a concrete example. One of the pushes for regulation we're seeing right now, and there's action on the Hill, is related to Internet of Things and connected devices, right? And so the value of your I actually question what the value of your toaster being connected to the internet is, but there are certain devices that when you do connect them to the internet, you gain certain benefits. A Nest
sure.
thermostat, for example.
I've got a connected crock pot.
Yeah, right. You can adjust it from your bed, or you know when you leave the home,
right.
The device knows you've left, and it goes into eco-saving mode. It actually benefits the environment, all with no regulation. So that's the benefit. But to make that product at a price that people want to accept, it uses low-cost, sometimes non-secure components, and it's pushed out into the marketplace, and now it's vulnerable to cyber risks. It can be used as part of a component when amassed with others as part of DDoS
right.
attacks.
Sure,
and
sure, sure.
So all of a sudden, this security risk comes about, and then the question shows up. So we're kind of at stage two. We let the permissionless innovation happen, and now we have a proven potential problem. So
yeah, and
the theorized problem, and now there's proof that the problem could be real, even though nobody's used the connected toasters to do this yet. They could.
And when that does happen, and I certainly want to make it clear that I take seriously these privacy, safety, and security risks associated with the Internet of Things and artificial intelligence and driverless cars and drones and any connected or network device, they are very real. We know they're real because they are real in the Internet context, so they will be real in the next generation of Internet-enabled or connected technologies. That doesn't mean we should foreclose the opportunity for ongoing experimentation and innovation to take place based upon these potential cases of harm. Instead, we need to have targeted solutions to those corner cases, and we need to remind ourselves, as I mentioned a moment ago, the common law isn't going away. There's still going to be liability. And where there's liability, there will need to be insurance, and there'll be other standards and players in the market that will help ensure that we have some adequate safety and security standards governing these things. Now, they will not necessarily be the same sort of overarching, preemptive, command and control type of regulations that we've seen in the past. And there was a serious cost with those regulations, and therefore we've moved beyond them. We've also moved beyond them because they're harder to impose or to enforce. And even the regulators understand that. And so what we're going to see in the future in terms of technological governance is a combination of common law standards enforced in an ex post fashion, as well as the rise of what's generally called soft law or multi-stakeholderism, which is generally speaking sets of best practices or codes of conduct that are developed in a collaborative way with government helping to convene a variety of players who come to a table and hammer out some best practices to deal with things like security for the Internet of Things or safety of driverless cars or the privacy aspects related to drones. And that's exactly what's happening in modern America today.
So I like that, but my sense is that that it would be, I think you and I would do backflips if that's the way things went. But I sort of, maybe this might be a place where we disagree, or at least I certainly disagree with some of your colleagues. My sense is that it's going to be hard to achieve that soft law, common law based model. And so the next dispute that I see in my head is between sort of a federal preemption approach versus a federalism approach. And let me sort of articulate my view, and then I wonder if it's consistent with yours, and then I imagine you could also offer the views of your colleagues who disagree with me. My sense is that if we have a federal preemptive approach where it's centralized and a central sort of government approach, this would be like the FAA's approach to drones and other aircraft. It's what we're seeing some people push for in the autonomous vehicle space. My sense is that's less than ideal as compared to a federalism approach, where at least if we could get Congress to say, this is a matter for the states and let the states work it out, we very well might have barriers to trade in a variety of different states, but we would at least get a government version of multi-stakeholder and competition, where California is going to do crazy things when it comes to autonomous vehicles, and Nevada will say, good, go ahead and do that, California, because we'll reap the benefits of commerce that's going to come to Nevada. And that competition will actually get us to better results than we otherwise would get with a federal preemption approach, even though it'll be less than optimal as compared to the soft law, common law approaches that you and I would favor if we could wave the magic wand. How do you see federalism playing into this in tech policy disputes, and are there some benefits we could derive from trying to push for federalism, or is my theory taking us in the wrong direction?
No, I think it's absolutely an excellent theory, and I think we already see this playing out today. It's what I call innovation arbitrage, and we're seeing the rise of global innovation arbitrage, where countries are competing for the next generation of emerging technology companies and sectors, and they're trying to make sure that they don't lose ground like they did in the internet, the first web wars, if you will. So the rest of the world's trying to keep up and trying to lure American innovators over. But this also happens at the state level in the United States. We've seen efforts to try to regulate, say, things like driverless cars sharing economy companies have engaged in. We've seen Uber bolt out of San Francisco, move down to Arizona, and then come back. We've seen driverless truck companies start in Nevada, move to Colorado, and then get lured over into Ohio. We've seen this happen with a variety of other sectors and technologies. Now, in some cases, federal law preempts this and in a plenary fashion sort of like clears the field of any opportunity for this to happen. And this is what we see with things like the FAA and the FDA for drones and medical devices, respectively. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for experimentation in a bottom-up fashion. At the same time, there is a compelling case to be made at the margin that some limited amount of preemption will be necessary, or Commerce Clause activity of some sort, to deal with truly egregious patchwork problems that could develop that could really stunt the growth of the interstate marketplace. So, for example, a certain amount of Federal Communications Commission regulation of spectrum probably made sense in the early days just to sort of say, well, spectrum's sort of everywhere, and we probably can't have a perfect patchwork approach to that. But the problem is every time we have a preemption, we get a lot of other baggage along with it. And trying to strike this balance is notoriously difficult. This was the topic of my first book that I wrote for the Heritage Foundation in the late 90s, and I've been struggling with this issue for the last 20 years and still haven't come to a satisfactory balance. But the reality is that I think the difference today is that the pace of technological innovation means that regulators and lawmakers at all levels of government have to be on their toes and more open to the idea of adapting or changing their laws more quickly to come into line with new technological realities. So that gives me some hope.
What's your sense of why they don't do it, right? So I don't see that impulse. I don't see the impulse to pause for a second. I don't see the impulse to see things play out. In fact, I think you were on a panel with Wendell Wallach, so you know this this theory that he advances, which is this idea of why don't we have like a waiting period almost, right? Like we should stop and like technology is moving too fast, so why don't we just slow things down a little bit to
right.
have this assessment period.
This is called the technological timeout.
And I see it actually the way the FAA does it, and actually what you saw the Obama administration do too is that these groups of sort of people who spun into administrations from tech companies say, oh, I know how to do this. Let's create a pilot program. Let's sprinkle around places for safe experimentation where we can have that controlled environment. So we're not going to have every road be a free-for-all, but we'll do it in limited environments where we've made a safety assessment that it's okay to start doing that. It's suboptimal, but doesn't it potentially work? I think Wendell thinks it
so
works.
I think it works to the extent that we have what I'll call an Empire Strikes Back moment here, where the state sort of reasserts itself and tries to bottle up technology that's starting to spread. I think those only really work effectively in a command and control sense, where you have technologies that are in what I call a bubble of or a box of what I call born captive technologies. These are technologies like food and medical device technologies, aviation technologies, certain types of financial services. There is no doubt that when you are dealing with a body of regulation that's already been in place for 7+ decades at the FDA, at the FAA, at the DOT, or wherever, you are up against a big, steep hill that you've got to climb to win back some freedoms for your technology, your sector. On the other hand, there is a huge and growing class of new, quote-unquote, born-free technologies that don't have these agencies or laws to deal with. I'm talking about various smartphone apps, social networking, 3D printing, virtual reality, general robotics, artificial intelligence, most other online services. These technologies don't have a clear regulator or a body of law, and what's interesting is that these worlds are converging. As Marc Andreessen, the famous VC venture capitalist, likes to say, software is eating the world. And so with each and every day, more of the born free stuff invades the born captive world. And as it does, the tension is on, the pressure's on the regulators to figure out how do we deal with this. All you need to do is look at how the FDA is struggling to figure out what to do with smartphones.
I'm curious, do you think that the reason they're struggling is because they start from, so they accept this sort of technological determinism, like technology's on the march, it's happening, you can't keep up with the pace of innovation, and then they only see costs and they see no benefits?
I think that's part of it. But the other part of it is that they also understand that they are resource constrained. And I'm not talking about just money or time. I'm talking about knowledge. The ability to keep up with the pace of technological innovation in these fields is significantly challenging, even when you have a formidable regulatory apparatus or infrastructure at your disposal. The Department of Transportation, specifically NHTSA, basically put out a framework for driverless cars last year, and it began with this astonishing admission that they were living in a different world and that they couldn't possibly keep up with all of the various things that were happening in this new world of driverless cars or connected vehicles, and therefore they needed to make some tough choices about where they were going to put their attention or their resources.
Yeah,
I found that to be an astonishing thing.
The FAA's done the same thing, and so
right.
where you'll see some of these multi-stakeholder groups that, you know, they didn't know how to handle registration, they got an industry group together to create some registration rules. They didn't know how to handle flight over people, got a group together to give them some insights on these types of matters as well, on flight over people and sort of what technologies exist. Same thing
so,
with sort of a remote ID requirement.
So let's make clear what's happening here. This is a form of technologically enabled deregulation. In my my thesis is this.
The way they're doing it, though, is there's it seems like deregulation, but actually it's we have this impetus to want to do something like identify all drones everywhere they fly. We don't really know what state of the art is to regulate this, so let's get this group of people together to sort of do our bidding for us is a bit more.
But is that group, here's the question, is that group accomplishing the same sort of command and control, thou shall not precautionary regime that the FAA might have imposed, say, 20 years ago? I doubt it. Now, FAA is a special case that probably can and does regulate more aggressively and comprehensively than other agencies. But, I mean, even the FDA, with its extraordinarily broad grant of delegated authority from Congress to regulate food and drug safety, has basically given up on regulating all sorts of technologies that involve health and food. Because they basically point out, like, we can't regulate all those medical and fitness apps that are in your smartphone. We can't keep up with all of them that are going up on the Google or Apple stores every single day. And this happens in financial services. This happens to some extent with driverless cars. So even those, quote-unquote, born captive in more heavily regulated sectors are starting to see at the margins some interesting forms of technologically enabled liberalization or deregulation without any laws being passed or any regulations being removed. And then you have the invasion of all those new technologies in the field that don't have any regulations covering them. So, in a sense, this gives me optimism.
I think you'll agree with me here that the shadow side of soft law governance is almost these threats of regulation, right? So if you're an emergent technology company or you're an entrepreneur, you'd say I'd rather not do these things, but my options here are go along and get along in the multi-stakeholder process that will generate a set of privacy best practices, or I might find myself getting regulated. So at least I can to hold this thing off.
But remember, as a cost benefit calculus, that's going to be a better one than having to go through a complete APA compliant regulatory proceeding and spend years trying to win a few selective freedoms.
Right, and so the voluntary multi-stakeholder process rules become something that someone says, "Hey, you guys have been doing this all along.
Right.
We should."
Yeah. There's always a threat of agency threats, or what used to be called in the FCC context, quote-unquote, regulation by raised eyebrow. And that is a very legitimate concern, which is the bullying tactics that regulators could use in a highly informal, decentralized administrative process like this. This has to do with the accountability and transparency and enforceability of soft law. But the reality is that the pressure's on them because the technology is continuing to move so fast that if they go too far with that threat, that people are going to pull an Uber on them. The Airbnb card comes out, and they just say, look, what's the heck with this? We're going to go do our own thing.
We should talk about it. So let's talk about that in a second, but I want to ask Devin. So we have another working group that listeners might be interested in, which is on this exact sort of issue of coercion, and it addresses this. What's the name of that working group, Devin, that addresses that agency coercion type?
Yeah, I mean, you've got it, Greg. It's the name of the working group is Enforcement and Agency Coercion.
Oh, that would be.
Yeah. So we have a short little write-up on our website, our recproject.org, about this group, and it reads in part, aside from the official rules and regulations, right, the agencies throughout the federal government have at their disposal, there's a vast array of powerful administrative and unofficial tools at their disposal to achieve their policy goals. So Enforcement and Agency Coercion Working Group, headed by Boyden Gray.
So let me tell you a little. So I'll add a personal anecdote here, and then I'd like Adam's reflections on this. And so there are a few approaches that a technology company can take when dealing with governments, particularly when dealing with heavily regulated environments. And we've heard a lot about disruption, right? And Adam, you've talked about technological civil disobedience, and we have the examples of sort of Uber just says, well, we're just going to go in and we're going to start operating and you'll have to deal with us, and we'll motivate our end users to put political pressure on you if you don't like it. And so I characterize that as the disruption model. And many others have used that term. It's not my characterization, but that's where I would put that example. So I faced a challenge in advising the company that I co-founded, and when they needed advice about sort of how to approach industry, I said, listen, when you're dealing with the FAA, you're dealing with a safety agency, you're dealing with sort of moving objects in physical space, and it's going to be hard to disrupt that. And so your next best alternative to disrupting that is what I call collaborative acceleration. And it's sort of, I feel like ashamed to say it, because you become something of a subject when participating in this way, but it might be the only possible way to move forward, which is you go in and work with the government and you make clear to them what technology can do. You demonstrate to them how fast technology can move. You find the places where you can move quickly in unregulated areas and use that as analogies to disrupt the regulation. But it has to accept from a starting premise that you have been born captive, or that you are a subject, and that you have to work collaboratively to accelerate, because if you don't do it, things will move entirely too slowly for the pace of technological innovation. And if you pursue a disruption approach, the power of that agency entity is going to come down on you. And so the examples that the company that I advise, AirMap, has done is participated in these multi-stakeholder working groups, done hundreds of technology demonstrations to educate the people in the bureaucracy about what technology can actually do. And we saw acceleration there, but it's different than a disruption model, and it's definitely not a technological civil disobedience. And so I'm wondering about Adam's thoughts, just kind of riffing on that idea of collaborative acceleration, I would love your feedback on it. I don't think I've ever tossed the idea over to you.
Yeah, so this is actually something that in the old days we used to just refer to as informal consultations, where innovators or companies would come in and sit down and talk about ideas before they ran them out into the marketplace with regulators. Today, this is actually a prevalent model, especially in Europe, and in particular in the financial sector, where it's called regulatory sandboxing. And the general notion is that's promoted, especially in the UK, is that financial companies who are looking to have new financial innovations and instruments released into the wild will first come in and have a private sit-down with high-level officials at the agencies, run the idea past the regulators without the fear of them being held liable for anything they air in that room, and that also their trade secrets, at least in theory, will be protected in that room. But at the same time, they get input from the regulators about, like, oh boy, that's a hot button issue. Can we ask you to maybe pull back on that a little bit, even as you move forward with these other few things? Now, of course, there's real dangers with this model, but I think it begins, you know, we have to begin with the assumption that you just threw out there, Greg, which is that we may be in a position in certain industries, and specifically financial services and aviation would probably be two of them, where you're not going to get away from the law and the regulation entirely. These are not just born captive. These are born firmly in a sort of regulatory prison, and you got to break free of that prison at some point, bit by bit.
Born captive in the dungeon with the chains being stretched.
Right. And so at this point, you just want to remove a couple of the chains, right, and get a little bit more freedom. And this is specifically the case with definitely almost all aviation technology and certainly a lot of financial instruments. And so the sandboxing idea is catching on, because the innovators know if they don't do this, there'll be some other country or city or whatever that will become the next great financial hub and offer people the ability to move there and set up those instruments in a more fluid, quicksilver world where innovation flows so rapidly and the global innovation arbitrage threat is there. They know they just can't say, nope, we're throwing down the gauntlet. You know, you can't do any of this. That
it's
just
totally
doesn't really work
not,
too often.
It's totally not permissionless, right? I mean, so on the permissionless
right.
spectrum, right, at best it's in the middle where but it's really not permissionless.
No, it's absolutely not permissionless, nor is it pure precautionary principle, right? This is more of a sort of anticipatory governance strategy that does not involve strict command and control, but does also not allow for complete permissionlessness. It basically says it's going to be a guided process with some borders or boundaries placed on the sort of innovative experimentation of these companies. But it does have the potential for opening the door to more innovation than we might have saw in the past, when, again, this all would have gone through an NPRM or a notice to propose rulemaking. It would have taken 5 years for any of this to happen. You know, the, NHTSA actually put numbers on this in their recent driverless car proceeding and said, look, we could probably behave more like the FAA when it comes to, like, aircraft approval. But, oh, we just found out that the FAA told us that the latest Boeing Dreamliner took 7 years and hundreds of thousands of hours of staff time to approve. And that's not going to work for driverless cars. I mean, this was NHTSA saying this. This was not me saying this.
The thing is so let's say on one end of the spectrum is permissionless innovation. The other is the precautionary principle. Then maybe I put my collaborative acceleration sort of in the middle here. Because it's suboptimal as we look at permissionlessness and suboptimal for precautionary, it is by definition attacked by both sides. And
right.
So you walk into the room having the sandbox discussion, and the precautionaries are saying, whoa, this is moving kind of way too fast. And the permissionless folks, if you find them in that sandboxing conversation, are saying, isn't this moving a little bit too slowly?
Right,
and,
right, right. Yeah, yeah. There's
left to say, well, this is my compromise. I'm trying to get you there. And really the thing, that's where the acceleration point comes in, is that the one variable on which it's trying best to optimize on is what's the speed at which you're willing to kind of accept this.
It's that's absolutely right.
It's like Wallach's like late wait and see, but it's not a wait and see. It's a boxed in innovation sort of world. It's I think we're getting close to the end, Devin. Do we want to maybe kind of wrap for now, and I think we have more to talk about in a future podcast, but I see us coming up on the time, and I thought I'd turn it back to Devin to see what his thoughts are on for wrapping up here.
Yeah, thanks, Greg, and thanks, Adam. I mean, that's been an incredible discussion, and I want to give both of you guys an opportunity on this podcast to give any final thoughts that you might have after, a wide-ranging policy discussion that primarily stayed at the level of whether and how government regulation can handle emerging technology. One of the things that I'm actually very interested in, maybe one of you guys can discuss this in your final thoughts, is if, let's take this down a notch. If I'm the disaffected voter, right, 2016 is seen in part as the year of the disaffected voter. I'm a person in middle America. I'm not, inventing some new technology. I'm not a part of some emerging technology Silicon Valley startup. Why does this matter to me? When I listen to this podcast, the argument, at least in part, is that, look, you have fewer services, disaffected voter, lower quality goods, higher prices for those lower quality goods and few services. Is that why I should care as a disaffected voter? Anyway, I want you guys to give some final thoughts, and then I'll wrap up.
Maybe Adam, you go first, and then I have some thoughts on this as well.
Great, thanks.
Well, relative to the past, there's simply no doubt that consumers have access to more and better choices and technologies than ever before, and increasingly a lot of those options have been provided to us at very low cost, if not free. I mean, I would ask the average median voter, do you like your smartphone? Do you like your search capabilities? Do you like your social networking services? Do you like to be able to go on and trade things on eBay or watch videos on YouTube or share photos through Instagram or Snapchat or whatever else? I mean, these are all services that at one point in time we paid a lot of money for, and they didn't work all that well. And yet it was because we embraced the idea of permissionless innovation for the information technology space that we got them all. And it was also important because it boosted American competitiveness at the same time. I'm fond of asking large rooms of people when I'm at hearings or conferences, can anybody in the room name a major innovation technology innovator from Europe? And not too many hands go up. And, this has really been an incredible real-world case study in why innovation policy matters. The European continent basically missed the boat when it comes to the first generation of information technology innovation, and America sort of won the day. And our companies here in the U.S. are now household names across the globe. So this is also about global competitiveness. And then finally, it's about living standards. And not just living standards in a broad sense of like more productivity and access to better services, but it also comes down to improving lives in very real ways. You know, we talked about driverless cars a minute ago. Every single day in the United States, 95 people die and 6,500 people are injured in automobile accidents. 94% of those are attributable to human error. So if we would have something like driverless car technologies on the road and on a fairly rapid clip, we have to believe that those numbers would come down and we could end up having the greatest public health success story of our lifetimes if we get policy right. So these are concrete examples of how innovation policy matters in everybody's lives, whether it's for your internet services you use, the cars you drive, the drones that maybe could deliver your product from your favorite online shopping site to your doorstep, or your medicine from your pharmacy, and everything in between. So these are real world manifestations of the power of technological innovation.
Yeah, I think like the whole podcast, everything Adam said is squarely in my worldview, and I that voter, like, why should they care? That average person, why should they care? I think they should care because we can show some examples where the regulatory impulse has been proven to be incorrect. And so, one example: robots are going to take our jobs, right? And so we have to regulate them because there's a potential economic disruption. And so, but then you look at the actual statistics: when some bank tellers were replaced by ATM machines, we actually didn't see a decrease in the number of bank tellers. What we saw was an increase in the number of bank tellers and other people employed at banks, because instead of having a person count out money, which is an easily automated task, that person was now repurposed into another job, right? And so the actual number of people employed by banks went up when ATM machines came out. Adam gave the great example, I think, of what I call the trolley problem for autonomous cars, right? Which is that we can do nothing on autonomous cars and continue to have people die, or we can have autonomous cars and lives will be saved. And so we have to take account of the benefits. The other things I think that average person needs to think about are the places in their life where they have significant pain points. And I imagine that the things that people don't like to do that have significant pain points have some regulatory touch point associated with them. And so, do you like going to the DMV? Well, the DMV is like an extensive inspection regime associated with being able to get your car onto the road. And that's an inspection regime layered on top of a bunch of regulations, right? And so wouldn't the common law potentially have some ways of solving some of those challenges? But let's say you accept that's an okay approach. Who likes filling out hundreds of documents every time you go to the doctor's office, or at least dozens, those pages of documents? Well, what's the reason for that? There's regulation piled on top of regulation, which makes it very difficult for the medical industry to transition from a paper environment to a paperless environment. And it's not just when you fill out those 12 sheets of paper, you hand those to a person that the doctor has to employ, whose sole job is organizing and retaining medical records at the doctor's office. And sometimes there's, you know, two or three of those people. Those two or three people, if we were moved to an innovative environment where those documents were stored in the cloud or electronically submitted prior to you getting there, filled out on an app, those two or three people might otherwise be employed as nurse practitioners or doing some other job, but we've created a market for compliance jobs. And then I have people who come up to me all the time at conferences, and they have a great new idea about a business related to the drone industry that they want to start. And their immediate question for me is, will I be able to do this? Will the regulator allow me to do this? And I'm not sure that I can raise the funding I need or get investors, because the investors are concerned about the regulatory environment, or the investors are concerned that even though the government has promised that the regulations may hit at a certain point in time, the government never hits their deadlines. And so you see businesses being stifled. You see opportunities in your daily life that are interrupted without a real case for why they're being interrupted, which kind of comes to the final part, which is that we all want to avoid harms, right? That's an easy thing for all of us to agree with. But what does the term harm actually mean? Right? What are the harms that we're actually worried about? It's easy to say, like, of course, like, don't you want environmental regulations? Aren't you worried about clean water? And is the difference really that we're going to have clean water or dirty water? Or is the difference that it's some, you know, millionth of a part, you know, within that water that's going to slow things down? And so we have to have these real kinds of questions addressed around this, and starting from the presumption that all new technology is harmful is the type of thing that leads us to fewer innovations, it leads us to slower developments, and it does place friction on the average person that they feel in their daily lives.
Outstanding final thoughts, fellows. Really appreciate you joining us today for the Federalist Society's Free Lunch podcast on emerging technology. On behalf of the Regulatory Transparency Project's Free Lunch podcast, I want to thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time for next installment of Free Lunch.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.